fucking freaky actors. That's what there's here. Masochistic directors. I should have known when he didn't even know what a cum shot was.
Hello and welcome to The Letterboxd Show, a podcast about the movies people love watching from Letterboxd, the social network for people who love watching movies. I'm Slim, she's Gemma, and each episode we are joined by a Letterboxd friend or two for a chat about their four favorite films. This week on the show, we're being taken deep into the heart of the erotic 80s by a very special pal. Somebody we and likely you have admired for her incredible work over the past decade on a podcast, delving into the forgotten and or secret her stories of Hollywood.
Yeah, we are totally, utterly delighted and somewhat intimidated to welcome the instigator and host of the brilliant You Must Remember This podcast, Karina Longworth. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, guys. Thanks so much for having me.
Karina, you've fully embraced the spirit of our four favorites format by selecting four erotic thrillers from the 1980s to discuss with us today, relevant to your new season of You Must Remember This. And for that, I just want to say thank you.
Well, thank you, guys, for binging some difficult material.
I had to go deep into my basement to watch these films this week since I work from home. Son had half days. It's spring break. I was like, nope, stay upstairs, please. And I do have to, I feel like Gemma is understating her appreciation for this week because Gemma's had to watch some movies that she would not normally watch this season on the podcast. So thanks. I feel like you're finally... Yeah. Getting into the swing of things.
Yeah, pretty much. Slim has had me, I don't know, he's had me watching Jean-Claude Van Damme. He's had me watching Commando. He's had me watching every Tom Cruise movie that he will make me suffer through. So this feels like my comeuppance. to get to the point, the films we will be exploring inch by sexy inch are, in chronological order, Paul Schrader's American Gigolo from 1980, Brian De Palma's Body Double from 1984, Adrian Lyne's 9.5 Weeks from 1986, and bringing it all the way back home to New Zealand, Roger Donaldson's 1987 erotic political intrigue, No Way Out. So, where to start? I mean, we'll go in chronological order, but I think we start with, you know, the current season of You Must Remember This is focused on erotic 80s. We are two episodes in at the time of recording, and I was just thinking about that amazing quote about Richard Gere being a liberated woman's himbo and thinking, Slim, what would you be?
I feel like I'm the dollar store podcast himbo. I compare myself to a dollar store Sean Fantasy, so maybe I'm a dollar store podcast himbo. But Karina, what brings you to the erotic 80s? What finally brought you into this theme for this season? What was like the onus for it?
Well, I guess I just started watching a lot of these movies in early 2020 when I suddenly had a lot more free time to watch things. And first of all, I just really like a lot of them and thought there were so many things to talk about. But it also kind of raises the question of why movies like this aren't getting made anymore and why blockbuster Hollywood movies have just become so sexless. And so it just got me thinking a lot about this period of time, the 80s and the 90s, when sex was such a bigger part of popular culture. And I had a child's memory of it because I was born in 1980. And so on the one hand, a lot of things happening in the late 80s and early 90s were really important to me in terms of like my development as a person going through adolescence. But on the other hand, I was not old enough to understand the complexity of these things at all. Mm-hmm. And so it felt like a really important thing to try to unpack it and understand it.
Richard Gere and American Gigolo will be the first one that we get into in just a moment. But 9.5 Weeks, to kind of like look at the four as a whole. So when I was a kid, 9.5 Weeks, I heard like whispers of this movie growing up, that this was kind of like the sexiest movie ever made. And it almost was like a mystique about that movie. So this was actually the first time I finally sat down to watch it after, you know, growing up as a kid with this like shroud of mystery around this movie. So I'm excited for us to get into talk about Mickey Rourke Mickey Rourke. Yeah. What a character Mickey Rourke
is,
right?
Oh, my God. I cannot wait.
American Jiggle, 1980, Paul Schrader. It's a 3.3 average rating. It's only got 22 fans on Letterboxd. When we go through these four movies, I actually thought these were kind of like low fans because the American Gigolo poster you see kind of everywhere on Letterboxd. And Richard Gere, the character, makes a lucrative living as an escort to older women in the Los Angeles area. He begins a relationship with Michelle, a local politician's wife, without expecting any pay. But one of his clients is murdered and an investigation begins. So he's sort of the suspect in this murder. And, you know, I highly recommend everyone check out the podcast as you delve deeper into the Richard Gere character in this film. But where does this stand for you in the history of, you know, 80s erotic thrillers?
Well, for me, it's the first and one of the best. You know, I think that not only is American Gigolo responsible for setting a certain style template for the 80s with the Armani suits and this, in general, Italian-inspired production design. But it's, you know, in a lot of ways, the first of its kind of the decade. And, you know, it really sets a template for, you know, what almost all of the movies that I'm talking about this season are about, whether they're thrillers or not, which is just this intersection between sex and danger and money.
I was thinking a lot about how that character of Julian has made quite a nice life for himself within the context of being a cool boy with the older ladies of Beverly Hills. So he's got access to all the clubs. He's got the beautiful suits. Like they take the time to show him packing and selecting shirts with jackets with ties and going back and going, no, that tie with this suit. And it's really interesting to then watch him have to get himself deep into the muck of the rest of the industry that he works in. That for me was the fascinating journey that I went through watching this. Not the romance with Lauren Hutton, but the, you know, the idea that he'd sort of somehow built a quite comfortable corner of the industry for himself, but it's sort of built on sand. It's built on that, you know, it just takes one of those rich ladies to cast him out and his house of sexy cards crumbles.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the film is very interesting about class. And Paul Schrader, the writer and director, has talked about how the American part of the title is a reference to a sort of a Horatio Alger idea, that this movie is not so much about gigolos, it's about Americans.
I mean, I'll be honest with you. I was Googling, how do I become an American gigolo after watching this movie?
Suits.
Yeah, suits like under my chest. His pants were so high up. I was like, my God, Richard, how do you do it?
You have to get those boots that let you hang from the chin-up bar upside down.
Oh, my God.
That's the prerequisite.
Those boots are wild.
And then what do you think he was pulling down? What do you think he was pulling down after taxes as a gigolo in 1980? I mean, I spent maybe 10 minutes thinking about it.
I think he was probably reinvesting most of his profits back into the business.
That's true.
In the Westwood apartment, the Mercedes, the cocaine.
Gotta reinvest in the cocaine. It's 1980. You have to. Mm-hmm.
I have one question. Why are Venetian blinds so goddamn sexy?
Well, it's sort of, they mimic, and they do this on the poster for the movie, right? They sort of mimic a blindfold. It's sort of about what you can see, the interplay between what you can see and what you can't see, lightness and darkness.
Yeah, of course. It's just so funny because, you know, I'm living in a house with Venetian blinds on every window, and I'm like, they're not sexy, they're just annoying. They flap in the wind.
Well, you know what else flaps in the wind? Oh. I'm sorry. I've really been liberated to make a lot of terrible puns and dirty jokes.
Please. Also, Hector Elizondo, Cigar King, I really appreciated him in this. I mean, Hector, I really only know as a television actor. And so this was a really lovely moment to see him in a role that I would have liked to have seen him play more of on the big screen.
Well, he and Gere will reunite in Pretty Woman in 10 years. So
yes, That's true.
Jack, who puts our facts together, this ranks 9 in Paul Schrader's filmography. Letterboxd list that it does appear on, these films have the D, period. Male frontal nudity in cinema and psychosexual dramas, nihilistic fever dreams, and surrealism with a touch of humor. So some good lists so far for American Gigolo.
Oh, no. I like the list that is actually sexy films. Yeah. Because there is that, you know, let's talk about that sex and danger line that runs through your season and all of the films we've chosen, because that, oh my God, that scene when he picks up the trick in Palm Springs for his mate in the industry and he heads out there and it's clear that the husband of this woman is a real piece of work. And that moment where it's just, you can see the husband in the background, the angle of the camera is on Richard Gere's face, husband in the background, and he's like, don't look at him.
Forget about him. This has nothing to do with him. This is just you and me.
I'm here for you. This is all about you. That, for me, yes, we got to see the D. We got that beautiful shot of Richard Gere lit by the Venetian blinds, full frontal, gorgeously naked. But no, for me, it was the words coming out of his mouth in that scene. Can we have more of that in movies, please?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was very radical to draw this character as being somebody who feels like it's his job to give women pleasure and to sort of help them, you know, understand that they can ask for what they want. In 1980, that was very radical.
I just love seeing him walking around, you know, helping shop, art galleries. You know, he's just like a sidearm piece to some of these women. And in some cases, that's all they really need at that time. You know, come with me, go shopping and find some expensive art. Let's hang out. I could do that. I'm on Google again right now.
There is something about the way that cities are shown in all of these films, actually, New York, LA, DC, the way that the cities themselves are so much a part of the affairs that these people are having, right? What did you love about the way that LA was portrayed in American Gigolo?
You know, I think that the very beginning of the film, like the first two images you see are of the Mercedes logo on his car and then of like the sparkling coastline. And I think for so many people, that is just, it captures in just two shots very succinctly what the America or the California experience, like the ideal California experience would be. It's money and it's the beach. And then, you know, this film sort of takes you from there, like down into the darkness a little bit. But it's still so seductive, just the night driving and the Rodeo Drive. And yeah, it's all part of this this tapestry of sex.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. I think one of the questions I've seen come up a few times in publicity around this season of You Must Remember This is, you know, how many of these films will be cancelled if they were released now? Mm-hmm. And I feel like this is one that wouldn't, because I feel like it's one that you could just take the script and put it on 2022.
I don't know about that. I mean, they are doing that. They're making a TV show with John Bernthal, but I don't know if it's set in the present day or set in 1980. I mean, for me, this movie is very much a time capsule. And I think like the specific things that it's certainly like the way that it's talking about relationships between men and women, I'd think that there would need to be some updating. And then the way that it encounters sort of the queer underground as it's pictured in the film, that would also need some updating.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Paul Schrader has said fairly recently, I think in a 2020 interview, that if he made the film today, the Gere character would be overtly gay rather than sort of coded as being, you know, maybe bisexual, you know, having it be so ambiguous.
One review I wanted to spotlight before we move on to our next film. This comes from Wood. Young Richard Gere as a sensitive gigolo is the most on-brand casting I've ever seen. Richard Gere, come home. We want more from Richard Gere.
Always.
I think it's De Palma time.
Oh, my God.
1984, Brian De Palma, 3.7 average, 333 fans. We're moving up on the list right now with Body Double. After losing an acting role and his girlfriend, Jake Scully finally catches a break. He gets offered a gig house-sitting in the Hollywood Hills. While peering through the beautiful home's telescope one night, he spies a gorgeous blonde dancing in her window, as they do at night. But when he witnesses the girl's murder, it leads to Scully through the netherworld of the adult entertainment industry on a search for answers.
Does it say the girl's murder? Is that the synopsis on Letterboxd? Witnessing the girl's
that's
murder?
That's what it
She's
says.
She's not like some 10-year-old. She's a grown-ass woman across the way.
We'll put a change into TMDB, the woman's murder. We'll see if we can get that updated.
Oh my God. I wrote an alt synopsis, by the way. I really struggle with these. Okay. A middling actor who's lost his job, his girlfriend, and his apartment witnesses a neighbor's murder, then suddenly becomes a private detective after seeing the dance routine of an adult star named Holly Body while watching some porn on the revolving waterbed of a Hollywood Hills house set.
That's pretty good. I'll give you props for that one. So what's your history with Body Double?
Brian De Palma is a filmmaker about which I have impassioned mixed feelings, as do a lot of people. And I find his movies sort of more interesting intellectually than satisfying as entertainment often. And this is a film where I think this is probably my favorite of his films in this vein. And I think it's the most sophisticated of his films that seem to be trying to be to Alfred Hitchcock what some of Todd Haynes' films are to Douglas Sirk, in the sense that they're sort of semiotic essays while at the same time attempting to be dramatically satisfying as well. And this is the one that feels the most successful to me.
This movie, Slim, how did this land for you?
This is the first time I've seen this. I feel like I've seen bits and pieces of it. And the first sit through, I was actually like really confused and perturbed. And then I saw some reviews, you know, obviously way over my head, like I said on the podcast Himbo here. But some reviews called out like, oh my God, the Alfred Hitchcock homage. Like, this is Brian's Hitchcock take. And then I like slapped my forehead and I was like, oh my God, yeah, it does totally feel that way. I don't know why I didn't catch that at first, because I was like, it was like the whole movie, I was like yelling at some of the characters, like, why are you doing this? What's that cop doing? He's not helping him at all. She's obviously getting murdered. But after I actually read some Letterboxd reviews, it kind of just woke me up to the fact that I think I just viewed it from a just totally different, incorrect lens on my viewing. And it just opened up my eyes to some of the fun of the movie, which I didn't kind of appreciate at first.
I think it's really fun.
I was blown away. I am so, like, every single podcast episode, I just say thank you to our guest for one specific movie. And this is the one for me, Brian De Palma's Body Double. Oh my God. So weirdly, I also saw Ty West's X in the same week, but basically I saw X and then I watched Body Double, and I feel like in a way they are a pretty good double feature in the way that they look at the construction of adult movies and the kind of the fantasy versus reality in terms of what actors and actresses go through. But X, I found the slowness of it, which is what Ty West is known for and which a lot of people love him for, I did not enjoy. But when Frankie Goes to Hollywood appears and starts singing, and there's this whole, we get to see the movie within the movie. I mean, when Melanie Griffiths says we had one of these in Star Wars about the revolving waterbed in the spaceship house. When she kicks him in the shin and calls him a weirdo, when she meets the other serious actress and gives her the business card and they have that amazing conversation. Like, the fun De Palma is having with the film industry here, whilst also making sure that every crane shot is above and beyond, every lighting decision, every camera move, just like fully bringing the camp to Hitchcock. I love this film so much. I don't love Craig Wasson, we could talk about that, but I love this film. Only thing wrong with it, I thought, is that Melanie Griffith shows up way too late, because once she arrives, it's like a whole other film that I wanted to see two more hours of.
You know, we're talking about the current season of the podcast, but how do you place this movie in that kind of echelon of 80s, you know, erotic films?
Well, there is an episode about this film coming up in a few weeks. And I mean, for me, like, it sort of fits in with this trend of a few other films. The fourth episode is about these two neo-noirs that come out in 1981, the remake of The Postman Always Rings Twice, starring Jack Nicholson and Jessica Lange, directed by Bob Rafelson, and then Body Heat by Lawrence Kasdan, which is sort of an unmarked remake of Double Indemnity. I think, like, there was an impulse amongst a certain generation of filmmakers, many of whom kind of grew up watching these classical Hollywood films and, you know, maybe having, like, you know, sexual feelings about actresses like Barbara Stanwyck or Kim Novak or whoever it was, wanting to kind of recreate some of the genre aspects of those films, but do it in this the time that they were working in where they could have more explicit sexuality. So for me, what Body Heat and Postman Always Rings Twice and a few other movies start, body double finishes, especially in terms of sort of making Hollywood do a car crash with the porn industry. And, you know, when De Palma was developing this film, he consulted with Annette Haven, who was a major adult film star. And it, when it came to casting the role of Holly Body, it came down to her or Melanie Griffith. And Melanie Griffith was at this point in her career where she was, you know, sort of considered washed up. She had started working when she was 16 or 17, and then her career had kind of gone downhill. She had had some personal problems, and she had just sort of made her return to cinema, making a film that hadn't been released yet, directed by Abel Ferrara, called Fear City, which if people haven't seen that, it's worth seeking out. I think that there are a few different versions floating around, but it's an interesting film, and she's really good in it. And so she really, it was like, it was almost taking as much of a chance on Melanie Griffith as it would have been taking a chance on an adult film star that had never done a non-porn film before, even though she had that lineage of being the daughter of a Hitchcock star.
I love that. She is incredible in this, but what I found, I mean, compared to all of the other films on this list, Craig Wasson, not a sexy guy. Like,
well, that's just kind of what I love about, that's one of the things I love about Body Double is that, first of all, Wasson is obviously absolutely an avatar for Brian De Palma, you know, and in ways in which De Palma doesn't even really try to hide when he talks about the film in terms of his own voyeurism and his own, like, feelings of, like, I love to watch women because I want to help them. And so I think that it's kind of important that Wasson, like, not be a Cary Grant type or a Richard Gere type, that he not be somebody who you're fantasizing about having sex with, because the whole movie is about his fantasies.
Mm-hmm. I'm, like, envisioning Jimmy Stewart in the role, and it's cracking me up.
Yeah.
I mean, I get that. You know, the only person I was attracted to was Melanie as well. So it's fine. It's totally fine.
one of the lists that this appears on is one that has come up before. And it's the Help, I Got Too Horny and Now Everything's Bad list. And also Cocaine Noir, Stoner Canon, and movies it should be illegal to watch before 9 p.m., as I referenced my basement viewing earlier. I can confirm this.
I liked Joe Carson's Letterboxd review that just says, best end credits of any movie ever. And it reminded me that there was a really intriguing credit, Body by Jake. And I was thinking, whose body do we think Jake worked on for this film? And it's got to be Melanie, right? Because it certainly wasn't Craig.
So I don't remember that credit, but is it referencing, like, Body by Jake? Because he was, like, a personal trainer with, like, a workout system.
Yeah, totally. It's referencing the Body by
Maybe
Jake.
Maybe he was just always on set, just giving tips to people, you know, giving shoulder rubs, like, you're doing great, you look great, you're not.
Because I was thinking it made sense to have him, you know, on American Gigolo giving Richard his upside-down chin-up thingies advice. But, yeah, no, I was intrigued to see that. Also, why are ankle bracelets so sexy? I'm building up a list here of things that are 80s sexy. Venetian blinds, ankle bracelets, there are more. As we go through the next two films, there are more.
Very thick carpeting that it takes a long time to drill through.
Yes. Oh my God.
That was another thing that perturbed me. He was so worthless for three quarters of the movie. Everything he tried to do, he was the worst at. Like, everyone he was trying to save or follow, they all got murdered. Yeah. Like,
I think there's something interesting. There's, like, a strain in some of these movies where it's like people can't even, like, you know, perform as men in their fantasies. Like, you see this at the beginning of Risky Business as well. Like, the Tom Cruise character is having a sex dream that, like, suddenly before the moment of consummation becomes like a I'm late for school dream. And so I think that that's a big element of body double too, is like for a lot of the movie, it's like a sexual fantasy / nightmare about not being able to perform.
I mean, the one thing he did do that was shocking was he did talk his way onto an adult film set. And he's in a scene, like, in the span of 24 hours.
I think the joke is that the barrier to entry is not so high. Yeah. Certainly for male performers.
Well, so I'm Googling, how do I become an American gigolo? How do I become an adult film star in 24 hours?
These must be the things that that delight and inspire you and keep you curious all day long. You've been making the podcast since 2014, and it's such a gift to film lovers.
Oh, thank you.
You told Long Reads, you know, talking about feeling burned out as a film critic, seeing 7 movies a week when, you know, you were only personally interested in maybe 30 films in a year. And I'm feeling that, given that Slim and I watch at least 4 films a week for this gig, let alone everything else. And so I guess reflecting back on 8 years so far of making the podcast, how has that changed your relationship with movies?
I don't watch new movies much at all anymore. I really only watch them when my husband is like voting for the Oscars, or if we have, you know, a friend made a movie, or if there's just like a, you know, a filmmaker who I'm already interested in put something out. But I don't feel the pressure to keep up with festival films, and I don't feel the pressure to see almost anything that Hollywood releases. So I'm just not part of that conversation at all.
You're like the opposite of film Twitter. I love it.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm active on Twitter, and the people I follow tend to be more interested in films of the past. But obviously, you can sort of select your own audience, and you can select your own reading material there. Mm. But yeah, I don't care. I don't care at all about Marvel or anything like that.
You mean you weren't first in line to see the Spider-Man Far From Home event in theaters?
I haven't seen a Spider-Man movie since the first Andrew Garfield movie, which I had to see, like, to review it. And, you know, that kind of movie is one of the reasons why I wanted to get out of film criticism.
What is the last movie you remember seeing as a film critic and going, thank heavens I'm a film critic because I get to write about this in an exciting and intellectual and loving way?
I don't think I really felt that. I felt excited to be able to go to festivals like Cannes, and to be able to, you know, sort of be amongst the first audiences to see international masterpieces. But I never felt lucky to be able to write about anything. I mean, it always just sort of felt like a chore, which is why I shouldn't be a film critic. Yeah.
But you should be a film historian. The Polyplat season is my favorite, I think.
Oh, great.
I mean, they're also good, but I love that one in particular because it sort of really shows up how the entire series and conceit is such a brilliant way of exploring how women and many marginalized people have navigated, I guess, the patriarchal and misogynistic Hollywood nooks and crannies in order to be able to build meaningful careers for themselves, even and often at huge cost. And I really loved the journey of Polly in that sense and the way that it was told. And yeah, I love all the links back to past episodes. There's this beautiful relationship going on from season to season. I just, there's no question in there. I just needed to tell you that I love it.
No, thank you so much. Well, that was a really, I mean, talk about feeling lucky. I felt really lucky that Polly's daughters, Sashi and Antonia, trusted me with her unfinished, unpublished memoir. And so that just felt like, the most exciting opportunity I've ever had is to be able to help tell Polly's story using Polly's own words.
Mm. Do you have some intriguing voices coming up this season, or is it all you?
I'm still really writing the season. I usually like to be a lot further along than I am right now, but I don't know why. It's just been really hard to write this season. So I've only written seven scripts of the first 12, and then I have to write the whole 90s season. So never say never. Like, I might get in a situation where I come across the perfect voice actor, or I decide that I absolutely have to interview someone. But generally, my approach so far has been that I I did have the opportunity to interview one director, and I decided not to do it because so much of the season, as I've already constructed it, is media criticism. It's so much based on all these vintage magazines that I've bought and kind of talking about the way these things were written about in their moment, that there almost isn't space for a voice of somebody still living looking back.
I need to ask, because it is my personal mission to make sure that this film is mentioned in every single episode of The Letterboxd Show. Will you be traversing Jane Campion's In the Cut?
No, because the season ends in 1999.
So. Of course.
I may mention it, but it's interesting that people have asked me about that film quite a bit as I've been talking about this season. And I have vivid memories of when it came out. I actually wrote something about it in graduate school. But this season is really specifically about the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, 100%. What are your memories of when that film came out? Where does it sit for you? Because in terms of what you are exploring in this season, as I was watching these four films even over the last week, I just kept thinking about, you know, as a young feminist in that milieu of all heterosexual sex is rape, seeing In the Cut and going, oh my God, this is what danger and sex in a movie together can be, in a way that makes me feel turned on even while a character is losing their head, literally.
Yeah, I mean, when it came out, I was really grappling with it and trying to understand it. I was only 23, I think, 24 maybe. Mm-hmm. For me, I found myself really drawn to it, but at the same time feeling like I didn't understand Meg Ryan's performance in it. And so that was actually what I wrote about, is I wrote about the film in terms of her sort of star persona, and how one thing that she had been very famous for before that film was faking an orgasm in a movie, right? In When Harry Met Sally. And then, as far as I know, this is the first movie where she performs an orgasm as though the character is actually having it. So I wrote about that and just sort of the sexuality of Meg Ryan and her persona and why, it felt like In the Cut was an intentional departure, but one that I wasn't sure was so convincing for her. And now I watched the movie again, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And I think I liked it more than I've ever liked it and, felt, I think it's a really great film. I still am like not entirely sure Meg Ryan is the best actress for that part.
And you know that it was originally Nicole's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't love Meg Ryan's hair in that movie. That was my main thing.
What? I think she looks great. I think the costumes are fantastic. Mark Ruffalo in that movie is just God level hot. Just but
off.
And Jennifer Jason Leigh is so great. Yes. But yeah, I still feel like, I feel like Meg Ryan's performance draws attention to itself because it's such a self-conscious departure from her kind of America's sweetheart persona.
It would have been,
I think, interesting to see what would have happened with an actress like Nicole Kidman or even if Jennifer Jason Leigh had played that part instead of the sister part, with an actress who I think could disappear into the role a little bit more.
I think what's been really interesting, I've talked about this before, but not in the context of what you've been saying, is that over the 10 years of Letterboxd history, the rating for In the Cut has risen slowly over time in a really significant way as more and more people explore it and either revisit it or come to it for the first time. And I think what is happening, I'm going to theorize here, is that those who did not know Meg as America's sweetheart, as Tom Hanks's perennial love interest, don't bring that with them to the film. And so maybe there's an accessibility that we didn't have because we were so much about Sleepless in Seattle and so much about You've Got Mail that it was quite hard to make that shift. Although I found it quite exciting at the time. I remember feeling quite liberated and empowered by seeing somebody who was clearly, clearly very good and very famous and very well paid for what they do, going, I'm going to do something else. It was like a shock to the system professionally.
I felt like that was happening quite a bit at that time, though. You know, another example from around that time is Charlize Theron in Monster. Like, I think that at that time it was sort of, I was feeling like it was sort of cliche for very famous actresses to kind of change their look and do something that was the opposite of what was expected of them.
True.
We need to continue on. We're talking about heartthrobs. Let's get to the one and only Mickey Rourke.
No,
1986, Adrian Lyons, 9.5 weeks, 2.8 average. So we're under the threshold of the 3.0 right now. 23 fans, though, on Letterboxd. An erotic story about a woman, the assistant of an art gallery, who gets involved in an impersonal affair with a man she barely knows about his life, only about the sex games they play. So the relationship begins to get complicated.
Another terrible synopsis. We might need you to rewrite most of our synopses
for this podcast.
I feel like one of the most important things about that movie is that she works at an art gallery.
Yeah, right.
You must know that going in.
Impersonal. Wow. Okay, so Adrian Lyne, first off, have you seen Deepwater?
Of course.
What did you think of Deepwater?
Wow.
I quite enjoyed it. I think that I'm very deep into Adrian Lyne's filmography right now, and so I'm very aware of the ways in which it sort of doesn't match up to what I think are his best films, including 9.5 Weeks. You know, as I'm sure we'll discuss, 9.5 Weeks has this really baroque sexuality. It has all these scenes that are almost surreal, and it almost doesn't even matter if they're sexy, but they are, you know, like florid and over the top. And Deepwater doesn't have any of that, but I still think it's so much more interesting than so many movies being made today. And I think the lead performances are really great. And I found it, you know, just sort of exciting as a movie about the decadence and depravity of a war profiteer.
True. Whereas I was distracted the whole time by how weirdly Ben Affleck rides a bicycle and the clothing he chose to wear whilst riding said bicycle. He's got a huge upper body.
I wouldn't be able to ride a bike with that kind of muscle structure up there. Yeah, I'd be falling over.
The placing of the seat, he needed to just sort of shift the saddle itself back a bit and raise the handlebars. I don't know. I just felt, yeah. Very distracting, Ana de Armas, I would look at her all day long. Speaking of which, is Kim Basinger one of the most beautiful humans to have ever been made?
I'm writing the episode about this movie this week, and I just read this article from Vogue when this movie came out that was just David Denby writing, 500 words about how beautiful he thought Kim Basinger was in language that I don't think would fly on Twitter today.
Right. And so I was very thankful to also come across the New York Times article from the same year about specifically talking to her about her experience.
And actually, if you're interested in that article, it is microscopic compared to this interview she did with Interview Magazine, where she talks about the same things in incredible detail. And you can find that on archive.org. They have the whole archive of Interview Magazine.
So how do you approach a film like 9.5 Weeks, knowing what we know about the actress's experience, but wanting to experience it as an audience member?
Well, first of all, I think that, you know, I think it's tempting, especially in the context of this podcast season, to talk about 9.5 Weeks the way we now talk about Last Tango in Paris, which I talk about in the first episode of this season. You know, it was received for decades as being a document of the sexual revolution, of sexual liberation. And now because Maria Schneider came out and talked about what her experience was really like on set, now we can see it as a document of abuse. With 9.5 Weeks, there wasn't that time lag. Kim Basinger was talking about her experience as the movie was in theaters, and people almost ignored it. At the same time, her experience is more complicated because she doesn't say this felt like rape. She also, in most of the interviews where she talks about how, Adrian Lyne and Mickey Rourke use these tactics to sort of create real situations to get real reactions from her, she also says that she felt that making the film was cathartic and it took her to a next level as an actress, and she sort of needed it like to experience things in her personal life. So I think it's not the same thing at all. That doesn't mean that the methods that Lyon and Rourke used were okay. And certainly I think that the way that Adrian Lyon talks about his movies, I almost want to tell him, go back into the past and tell him to shut up, because yes. I think he tends to do them a disservice.
Not just about his movies, but about his actresses. You know, he yeah. talked about Kim Basinger and said, you know, she's not an intellectual. She's not a, she's not clever.
Books,
yeah. She's, yeah.
Right. But I mean, to the credit of the author of that New York Times piece, which I think was Nina Darton, she gets Basinger's response to that. When, you know, she allows Kim to defend herself against those charges. So, I think it's a very complicated situation. This is my favorite Adrian Lyon movie. I think it's him working at the highest level. And I think that, you know, you can understand that the methods for making it were complex and bad. this movie was kind of a disaster in terms of production and post-production. It took them 18 months to edit it. All the test screenings were extremely negative. And Mickey Rourke ended up kind of disowning it because he said he didn't feel like the movie went as far as he wanted to go. And so then he went and made this movie called Wild Orchid, which we'll also talk about on the podcast. So you can put aside all of that. You can put that to one side of your brain. And then the other thing you have to put to the side of your brain is the source material, which was a memoir slash novella written under a pseudonym by a woman who was writing about her own experience of what began as a consensual S&M relationship and then left her with a nervous breakdown. So those two things can be in your head when you watch the movie, but I also think the movie stands on its own and is somewhat undeniable as a portrait of a relationship through the eyes of the woman that is extremely ambiguous, and it's very unclear the whole way through where the line is in terms of consent and abuse and pleasure and pain. And I think its unwillingness to make declarations at every step of the way is fascinating. Mm-hmm. I just think it's a very powerful, beautiful film. Troubling, but beautiful. For me, it works for me the way that I think Last Tango in Paris works for other people.
In Adrian's filmography, this ranks 7, only ahead of Indecent Proposal and Deepwater, and it's still the top-rated film of the 9.5 weeks trilogy, which Jack just
I didn't know there
existed.
Were 3.
Oh my God, there's 3?
Mickey's in the second one, at least, but he does not return.
The second one is, it's not... I think they're both sort of unofficial sequels.
Yeah, the average rating on Letterboxd for 2 is like 1.9 or something. Yeah, very, very low.
Yeah. Thing is, I remember watching this as a baby teenager to, you know, watch the thrilling, sexy bits and not remembering much about it other than that the food scene has been much parodied. But watching it this time round, I felt everything that you have just described, Karina, about... I feel like the discourse around the film back then was all about how freaking erotic and weird and dangerous it was, apart from the gross cough medicine bit. But I felt like for me it was kind of a gold standard blueprint for what to watch for in an abusive relationship. And it was for me not just the way in which Adrian films New York. I mean, that shot of the cat with the rat in its mouth, but also the flea market sequences, the sequence inside the Chinese grocery store, the way we get to see and know and understand what the city is like to live in. But it was also the melancholy elements of Farnsworth, the painter, and Liz going back to her apartment and watering her sad plants that she's been neglecting because she's been bound up in John's needs. And yeah, really... I really loved the way that it threads that needle of when it all turns from fun and games and your sexy secret into sad and stressful, and you start observing other people laughing and other people having a good time and the kids over the fence from your apartment jumping up and down and playing and smiling and reflecting on what it is you've lost by taking on this relationship. I just was really struck by how much deeper 9.5 weeks is than the film that you think it is when you hear the title.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it does have this reputation as being sort of a silly softcore film. Mm. And, you know, it takes, I think, something like 45 minutes for there to even be a sex scene.
Right.
You know, it's I think it's just about, it's about sex and how it fits into this woman's life. And it's a very complicated sexual relationship. But it's, you know, the movie ends up being so much about what it feels like to be vulnerable and powerless and in some ways enjoy that. And then in other ways, understand how self-destructive it is and how destructive it is.
And it's also got a fair dollop of humor. I mean, this is Nora's review on Letterboxd. Wow, the 80s was such a wild time. Like, what psychosexual thriller today would include scenes such as the main couple paying a small child to fart the theme from Jaws?
Yeah. Yeah, there's some wild, wild stuff in this movie. And most of it is not sexual.
No, I do. I've got another 80s thing to add to my list of things that are 80s sexy. Why is Roxy Music so goddamn sexy?
Well, the scene set to the Brian Ferry song, Slave to Love, in this movie is really interesting, I think, because it's put together like it's a rom-com montage, but what you're actually watching is this man make his girlfriend stand in the rain without an umbrella while he has an umbrella, and then feed her soup in bed when she gets sick. So it's basically Phantom Thread, like in a montage. But it's stylistically, you know, it's like we're being delivered it as though it's romance.
Jenna's review, which I agree with, Mickey Rourke has one facial expression and it's a devious smirk. I mean, from the get-go.
He couldn't even do that facial expression a couple movies later after he got his cheek
stamped. So, oh, my God. You know,
savor the moment.
I did want to talk about Mickey Rourke a little bit.
Yeah, can we?
Going back into some older movies. You know, I think I grew up with Mickey Rourke, probably like The Wrestler was maybe one of my first introductions, and the Expendables movies and his various, you know, facial surgeries today. Looking back on his filmography, and he almost feels like a Shia LaBeouf character. Like, he reminds me of Shia for some reason. I don't know if it's like the quote bad boy for better or worse image, because, you know, he eventually went astray. But I think he has such a fascinating career. He's such a strange character in some of these movies. And, you know, it makes me want to watch other ones. I think I watched like Marlboro Man. What was that other one that he did with?
With Don Johnson. Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, for me, and I, you know, I am, as I said, I'm writing about 9.5 weeks, and there's going to be an episode in which I talk quite a bit about his star persona. For me, this is kind of the end of the line. Like, it stops being interesting for a long time after this. Yeah. You know, you could, another one shortly after this that you could try is Angel Heart, the Alan Parker movie. But
that
movie is pretty crazy, and I'm not sure it's good. There's just kind of a long slide, including this movie Wild Orchid, which I'm going to be speaking about in the podcast. But I also really like The Wrestler, and I was, you know, kind of rooting for him on that Oscar season, but I think the more you read about Mickey Rourke, the harder it is to root for him.
Found my Angel Heart review. I want to meddle myself again. 3.5 stars in Letterboxd. My last line, Mickey Rourke has a flatter ass than I do. That was my main takeaway from Angel Heart.
Well, I'm glad that Mickey Rourke and Angel Heart made your man ass list on Letterboxd. Because I was going to say, in terms of 9.5 weeks, not that I necessarily these days would want to see Mickey Rourke, you know, all as God made him. But I feel like, you know, you know he's not a good guy when you never see him naked in the film.
Yeah, actually, it's funny. He did this long interview in Playboy shortly after this movie was made. And, you know, somebody is like, you know, well, you know, it's a very sexy movie. And then he interrupts the interviewer and says, you know, like, I never take my pants off. Go back, watch, you'll see. I never take my pants off.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's this weird sort of point of pride. I mean, this is not a movie with a ton of nudity in it.
No.
You know, oftentimes they're having sex like in public furtively, so nobody's taking their clothes off completely. But certainly Kim Basinger does disrobe more than Mickey Rourke does.
I did get quite upset, especially in a COVID-inflected environment, about a lot of those sex and alleyways scenes. I was just like, no, just no. But I feel like so far in all of these films, we've only seen all of Richard Gere, which was very, very nice. And there's just not enough of that. I remember who I was thinking of now. It was the 1972 Cosmopolitan insert.
Oh, Burt Reynolds.
Burt Reynolds. Mm-hmm. My mum had that on her wall. I grew up with that as my first, you know, kind of like, you can thirst after a man and he's mm-hmm. a hairy bear of one. And then we see Richard Gere in American Gigolo. And finally, we come to not a lot of Kevin Costner, but we do need to talk about the jeans with the top button undone, the snail trail, the low-rise jeans in Roger Donaldson's 1987 political thriller, No Way Out. This has a 3.3 average on Letterboxd and only 6 fans. So if you are one of those fans, go and find the other 5 and have a dinner party and talk about Kevin Costner and those jeans. Oh my God.
Well, hopefully there will be more fans after my episode of the podcast where I talk about yes. Kevin Costner as an all-American wholesome sex symbol.
Let's go there. I love this film. This is only the second time I've seen it. The first time around, all I really remember is watching it with my dad at the movies, which didn't happen very often, so pretty exciting.
It's a big dad movie.
Yeah, it's a big dad movie. And being quite appalled by the Kapa Haka Māori concert party, which were not Māori actors, at the New Zealand Embassy event that Navy Lieutenant Tom Farrell finds himself at one point. But anyway, so plot-wise, as you said, Kevin Costner, all-American man, he's a Navy Lieutenant who's brought in by the Defence Secretary David Bryce, paid by Gene Hackman, to basically prop up his political ambitions by having this naval hero with him. And along the way, Tom Farrell meets Susan Atwell and they share a passionate fling in a limousine. We will talk about this scene. And then Farrell finds out that his superior, the Defence Secretary, is also romantically involved with her. There is sex, there is a death, there is a very long second half of the movie set solely in the Pentagon, and it's great. I love Roger Donaldson. He made the film Sleeping Dogs, which brought Sam Neill to fame, basically. This was his first major leading role, and it is it's a great film. Even now, I love it so much. And I just love Roger's grasp of action and these kinds of characters, you know, this kind of politics meets sex meets, yeah, I love it.
When you say that the second half of the movie is set in the Pentagon, I mean, for a movie where the second half is set in one building, I mean, it's really thrilling. It's really well done.
This is the first time I watched this movie, but I've seen the poster many times over the years. I was going to make one of those like quirky joke letterbox lists afterward because this is the second movie I've seen this year where Will Patton plays a closeted gay man working for a powerful boss and he commits murders for his boss. The other one was Thomas Jane's The Punisher.
Oh, interesting.
A strange double feature for this film.
Yeah.
I also did not know that this is the third adaptation of the source novel, The Big Clock. So there's a 1948 version and a 1976 version, Police Python. Have you seen those?
I didn't know about the 1976 version, but I've seen The Big Clock, the film noir, yeah.
So how does this stack up?
This one is quite different than The Big Clock. I chose this movie to talk about on the podcast and here kind of like at the end of my process of doing research to try to figure out what I'd be talking about. And it was because of really of like the chemistry between Kevin Costner and Sean Young, which is, I think, you know, pretty exciting. You talked about this limo scene. These two have sex before they know each other's names and they do it in the back of a limo, which is, you know, just not something you're going to see in a movie anymore. And it really kind of sets the tone for this movie where it feels like it really is. It is thrilling in a lot of different ways.
I mean, you might see it in a movie, but it'll be someone having sex with the limo if you are Julia Ducournau, right? That's the kind of sex we're getting in films these days.
Yeah, I guess I should have said a Hollywood movie, but yeah.
So would you have approached Kevin Costner at that party if you were Sean Young, if you see him waltz around in his uniform?
Stoli, straight up.
So I was impressed.
Yeah, want a drink?
Same.
Make it two.
All right, ladies, do you think
you one of them?
No, one of who?
These hypocrites, all fat and shiny, gearing up for another 4 years of ramming it to the rest of us. Are you one of them?
No.
I mean, I think he's, I never really understood why people thought Kevin Costner was sexy until I saw this movie.
Thank you. Me neither. I was just like, was it that Robin Hood? He did Robin Hood, The Bodyguard. I mean, I'm like, I don't get it, but this I get.
The Bodyguard, I think he's kind of uniquely unsexy in, which is too bad because when that film was made, it was still extremely unusual to have an interracial couple in a Hollywood movie. And it feels like there's sort of a missed opportunity there. But the only other movie in which I think that, you know, I can really see him as being sexy is Bull Durham.
Speaking of, I just want to say the wonderful Film School Rejects, who do the hard work for us of listening to directors' commentaries, they listed the 27 best things they learned about No Way Out from Roger Donaldson's commentary. And on that limousine scene, do you know about this? So he visited DC to scout locations and he was met at the airport by a long stretch limousine. And being an Australian-born New Zealander, he was like, I don't like it. This is not me. I'm going to sit up front with the driver. So he's chatting with the driver, asking him if passengers ever get up to mischief in the back. And the driver's obliging with stories and describing how he just adjusts the mirror to get a full eyeful. And so then when it came to shooting that scene, Roger Donaldson tracked down that driver and cast him as the limo driver.
Wow.
And that is why he was so convincing. He was good because he wasn't creepy about it. He was just like, oh yeah, here we go. I see it all the time. I'm just going to adjust the mirror.
Like I said, this is the first time I saw it. I thought the ending was pretty shocking to me. Like,
there is a big
going
twist.
Full reveal
yeah,
about
there's
that.
There's a big twist. And I the first time I saw it, I was pretty mad at the twist, to be honest. you know, there's another film that I'm talking about this season called Jagged Edge, which also has a twist ending. And I think this movie's twist ending, as mad as it made me the first time I saw the film, I think it's much more successful.
Yeah, 100%. And I think I had forgotten, fortunately. I mean, it'd been so long since I saw it that I had forgotten. So I got to be shocked and mad and then intrigued all over again and able to go back and plot certain moments where he orders certain types of drinks, you know, for example, or just all sorts of things. I was just thinking about, made me think, obviously, it sounds really film school 101 to say, but about all of the different meanings of No Way Out, you know, as they apply to there's no way out as a woman in this world. There's no way out of the Pentagon. There's no way out of the KGB. There's no way. Yeah. 80s sexy sailing. Why is sailing so sexy? Oh my God, that sailing scene is just insane. He's in his little shorts. She's in her shorts. Oh, they're just having a nice time. They don't actually have sex on the boat, but it's just sexy. I love that. However, I do think Letterboxd needs a master list of all the people who die in movies by falling onto glass tables.
Oh yeah. Well, that can go. That can go with your Venetian blinds on your list of 80s sex film tropes. Just broken glass in general.
Yes. There was a list that I loved going through when you had to investigate a murder you committed or one where the evidence points to you. And there's like 40 movies on that list. I thought it was a dynamite list.
I looked up, do you listen to Fatal Attractions pod?
No. What's that?
Fatal Attractions. It's a podcast where they go through erotic thrillers. I looked up where these films rank on their ranking. So as they review each erotic thriller on each episode, they rank them. Body Doubles at number 27, American Gigolo is at number 36, 9.5 Weeks is at number 65. And I don't think they've done No Way Out yet. But speaking of Letterboxd lists,
I can't imagine what's it like in the top 10 if these movies are so low down.
Yeah. I am going to tell you.
I mean, maybe they're all from the 90s.
Well, what do you think number one would be when it comes to erotic thrillers?
I mean, if it's called Fatal Attraction Pod, then seems like it's clue.
Well, you're close.
I mean, I would figure either that or Basic Instinct.
Yeah, it's Basic Instinct. So Verhoeven is at number one, Body Heat at number two, and Fatal Attraction at number three.
Wow.
So those are the top three.
Namesake of the pod, and it's not even number one.
Yeah. Dangerous Liaisons. Oh my God, Single White Female.
Dangerous Liaisons is not a thriller, though.
Yeah, true.
I mean, my season is not about all thrillers either, but.
Right. Well, what can we expect? I know that the 90s are coming later on the pod, but how has your thought process been for which to select and which to choose down the line?
For the 90s, I haven't figured it out yet, to be honest. But for the 80s, you know, once I kind of locked into this idea that it's basically one or two films per year, once I was thinking about things that way, it became pretty evident, you know, what was going to go for each episode. Actually, the only thing that was sort of in question was the year of 1988. And once I decided that I wanted to include No Way Out, which is actually from 1987, that's when I kind of hooked into this idea of talking about Kevin Costner and his emergence as a star, because Bull Durham is 1988. And so I can sort of talk about him as this weird, like, corn-fed sex symbol, and also at the same time talk about his star, a co-star in No Way Out, Sean Young, who had a really fascinating career, kind of short-lived, was sort of chewed up and spit out by Hollywood in a really interesting way.
Will you go into any teen films? Because, you know, I think a lot about films like Pretty in Pink and James Spader in that film and the way that he as Steph just looks Andy up and down. And although they never have sex, it's just infused all the way through his performance. And there is sex in that film. Well, we don't see it, but you know, I feel like teenagers had a lot more sex in American movies in the 80s than they do now. I mean, everybody did. Everyone had a lot more sex than they do now.
So I am going to talk about James Spader, but not in the context of that film. At the end of the 80s, season, I'm going to talk about him in two movies, Bad Influence by Curtis Hanson and Sex, Lies, and Videotape. But in 1982, that was sort of the year of the teen sex comedy. So I have an episode about that in terms of Porky's, which is a terrible film, and Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which is a better film.
Is James Spader the ultimate sex symbol of the 1980s, yes or no?
Well, actually, I mean, I think that some of the stuff he did in the 90s is sexier and more interesting, like Dream Lover and Crash. You know, I think that, but I mean, Sex, Lies, and Videotape is a really interesting sort of bridge moment between the two decades. And, you know, that it comes out sort of right before the rating system changes. So the X rating becomes NC-17, which is also an important part of the story of all these movies that I talk about this season is how they play games with the rating system.
And you need to listen to You Must Remember This for that, because it's just, it explains so much about why we're seeing and not seeing what we're seeing and not seeing now. But 80s, 90s, or otherwise, what for you is the sexiest film you've ever seen? Or the one that first gave you teenage feelings?
Gosh, I don't know. I think probably the first like really sexy movie I saw in a movie theater where I was sort of uncomfortable was Sliver, starring Sharon Stone, which I saw at the Universal City Walk when I think I was in seventh grade. And, you know, that movie, she's like definitely having like sweaty gym sex with William Baldwin, and he's videotaping everyone in the apartment building. So you're sort of seeing like grainy footage of other people have sex. And that, I think that was just a movie that like had a vibe that was sort of unable to, like, you couldn't deny that there was a vibe in the movie theater.
Gorgeous. Now, you don't have a Letterboxd, and that's fine. This is a safe space.
A safe space.
A judge-free zone. But a Letterboxd member by the name of Beth Winchester has done an incredible job of documenting all the films you've ever mentioned in every season of You Must Remember This. So she's got a You Must Remember This master list. Have you seen it? Are you aware of it?
No, I mean, we've been doing that on our website. I guess we don't have to. She's done it.
I will say, lay the last number for this episode, there's 1,564 movies on this list, of which, this might shock you, I've seen 9% of.
Thanks for listening to The Letterboxd Show, and thanks to Karina Longworth for allowing some of her podcast excellence to rub off on this humble little show. You can't follow Karina on Letterboxd, but you can and should follow You Must Remember This on Twitter and all good podcasting platforms. And you can follow Slim, myself, and our HQ page on Letterboxd using the links in our episode notes. Slim, I think I need a week off after those four films.
Gemma, we will be taking a week off next week from the Letterboxd show. We need to recharge our batteries after the last four faves that we just watched. But there's some good news. We still have our other podcast, Weekend Watch List, dropping every Thursday with Mitchell, Mia, and myself. So thanks to our crew this week, Monica for the theme music, Vampiros Dance Attack, Jack for the facts, and our booker, Linda Moulton, for looking after our guests, and Sophie Shin for the episode transcript. NTU for listening. The Letterboxd Show is a Tape Deck production. See you in a fortnight. That's 2 weeks when Gemma has recovered.
Slim, you knew it would be over when one of us said stop, but you wouldn't say it.
Work and you work and you work. You meet with people that you don't like, that you don't even know, that you don't even want to know. And they try to sell you things. You try to sell them things. Then you go home at night, you listen to the wife nag, the kids bitch. You turn up the TV, you tune everything out, you get up the next day and you start all over again.
This is a Tape Deck Podcast.